Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines. They're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. This episode is part of a mini-series called Crossover Moments, where we explore key moments of personal transformation. We talk to industry experts about the pivotal moments that led them to question and ultimately reject or let go of conventional approaches to sustainable fashion, breaking defaults and choosing alternatives. Today, Dr. Divya Jyoti and I are in conversation with my co-founder, Jessie Lee, who shares with us the story behind her crossover moment. Jessie's journey through the fashion supply chain in China and Cambodia has given her a unique perspective, shaping her conviction that supply chain relationships are way more complex than we think, and the people involved often get the short end of the stick. She talks to us about her initial perspectives on sustainable fashion, her personal experience while working in a buying office in China, and how it became a pivotal awakening moment for her. Divya, Jessie, because both of you were such a big part of coming up with the concept for this mini-series, and because this concept is a little bit different from the other series we've done in the past, I thought it was worth having a quick chat about how we arrived at this concept and why we're so excited about it. Do you want to go first, Divya?
I think in the work which I've done with you and what I've, you know, listened in terms of the previous episodes of The Manufactured and the different guests, I think one thing became clear, and that was there in our conversations, if I go back and think about how we got here and why this mini-series is people. While there is so much of discussion around these technical aspects of, oh, what is decarbonization? How do you define it? Okay, what is a clean factory, green factory, compliant factory? I think it's always people. What I found in my journey, and I know from my conversations with both of you and others who are probably listeners of this podcast, but a part of the community, is the energy that we draw from each other as people, as individuals. And I think for me, one of the motivations and the exciting part about the series is recognizing that, you know, it is the individual, it is the personal, which shapes and informs the debates. I think Manufactured as a space was generated out of that. And a lot more has happened since then. So, you know, the work that we've done in different other capacities, I think. So in one way, I think this was to recognize the human side of Manufactured itself, but also the conversation that Manufactured tends to highlight. But having said that, there are moments, and I think that was the key point, if I try and recollect from one of the informal conversations where the idea emerged, was that it's often, you know, that you are completely convinced, passionately driving, wanting to bring about change. And then something happens which just disrupts your world as you know it. And that's where you want to kind of do something different. So I think those are the two bits I remember about, you know, why this makes sense to do this and why we are here.
How about you, Jessie?
I think my motivation and my interest of doing this are coming from two things. First is I somehow don't believe in career development. I do believe if you have an intention, if you have a plan, if you are determined, yes, that could help you to achieve something. But I don't believe individual's life or self-development is a linear thing. I don't believe you can plan it and you'll go for it and you will arrive there. I don't believe that. And the second thing I think is we don't know who we are until we encounter something. That said, I don't know who I am until I encountered a challenge or a choice, a very difficult choice or an opportunity. Then by making a choice of the options in front of me, I understand better who I am. And if I look back, to my life, I realize I am the whole range of choices I've made. And that's how I understand who I am. So when the two things come up together, I realized this is the crossing over moments we are talking about. And this is the, I would call it waking up moments. You wake up, you realize who you are. Mm. you are not somebody told you who you are, but you are the choices you made. And you can only understand the choices better and better when you keep looking back. And another thing make me feel very interested is when lots of individuals come together, share their crossing over moments or share their understanding about the choices they make, I believe those pieces coming together can reflect a bigger picture. So things manufactured at the first place wants to interview so many suppliers. And I still remember we are so busy with so many topics, so many suppliers and so many stories. As Divya said, it's a story about people. We focus on people. So when so many people's reflections coming together, I believe that can reflect a big picture. And what is this big picture? Of course, we all have our understanding. But why we are here, Kim and Divya and me, why we are here is because we want to also pull the clues. We want to pull the strings. Like we want to lift the curtains to show, look, this is a big picture that manufactured podcast try to review. It's not just individual's life story or individual's experiences. Actually, if you put all those pieces together, you will see a bigger picture. And of course, that's up to the audience to say what they saw, but also we have our preference to provide as a choice.
When we first started thinking about manufactured, my personal motivation in starting this show was sort of twofold. One was that, like, I went into my experience as a factory manager in Cambodia with certain ideas about what sustainability should mean. And while I was doing that job, sort of one by one, my assumptions or ideas about what sustainability should mean and how it should be done were kind of like dismantled or dissolved, or, you know, I kind of like had to put them to one side. And not because I didn't believe in the mission or in the cause anymore, quite the opposite. I was just as passionate as ever about the need to change fashion supply chains. But my ideas about how to do that kind of changed quite a lot as a result of my personal experience. And I was never explicit about this, but I kind of hoped that, like, if you could get more perspectives from the supply chain out there on these topics, that it would be a way of, like, bottling up those experiences and allowing people who maybe hadn't had the chance to live them themselves to go through them. And in a way, I think that's also like why the community and the personal connections that have grown out of this podcast are as strong as they are. And Divya, you once described the show as like a myth-busting show. You know, we've never described ourselves as a myth-busting show, but I agree with you. I think in many ways, that's what we've been doing, right? We've been putting forward stories and lived experiences that maybe poke holes in our assumptions or ideas about how sustainability should be done. And so I think it's nice now to sort of honor that history of the show in a more explicit way. All right, we're going to switch gears here for a minute, and well, more than a minute. And we're going to start with Jesse, some of your crossover moments. And I, to be honest, I'm dying to know what you're going to say, because we've spent hours and hours and hours talking about so many different things. And I know you shared with me that you had something new that you wanted to talk about that I hadn't heard about before. So you've already piqued my curiosity. But can you just situate us? By situate us, I mean both literally, where were you? What was your role? Who else was part of the situation? What's the sort of context that we need to know to be able to understand what it is that you're going to talk to us about today? But also from a conceptual point of view, what assumptions did you have going into this encounter about what was good and what was bad, or what was sustainable or what was unsustainable? Paint us a picture.
Okay, I will try my best. When I say I have a new story, I don't think I shared this much with many people. I was in Shanghai in China in a buying office for brands. We were taking care of orders placed to China, and my role is on the brand side. And before the crossing over moment, I would say, if you ask me what is sustainable fashion, my answer would be very simple, actually. Sustainable fashion means it has to be mutually beneficial. It has to be good to the environment and good for the end consumers, specifically on the health. The product has to be no harm to people. So that's my simple understanding about sustainable fashion, mutual beneficial and good for the environment, good for people.
Mutual beneficial, you mean commercially for the different actors or like in a different kind of way?
Yeah, it's commercially, but not just between brands and suppliers, also within the supplier's own facilities. So it means if the factory management get benefits, then the workers should get benefits too. If there is a factory can deliver the goods very fast, on time, and with good quality, cheap price, but the workers are suffering, I wouldn't call it as mutual beneficial. So that's what I understood at that time. So anyway, it's a small buying office, but we carried out the orders, I think, annually. The total volume would be millions of euros. And the office is a kind of flat management. We only have the two bosses. One is the buying office boss. One is me, the merchandising manager. And then we have a small team. We choose a flat management because we don't believe in the hierarchy culture in office. So we basically discuss all the orders, discuss all the challenges, problems. In that case, I was quite aware what's happening in our communication with suppliers. We had lots of stress from the buying teams. All sorts of last-minute changes, all sorts of crazy price negotiation. Every season, we needed to be how much percentage lower than the previous season, and how tight the shipments were, and so on, and so on, and so on. So at the end of the first year, everyone was pretty much exhausted and burnt out. And I don't really know, is that because we are so close to suppliers, or is that because we were in China? Somehow we felt more empathy to the suppliers' life. Also, we had quite close contact with them. We visited the factories almost every month, and we had very close communication to know what kind of problems they had at that moment, why they cannot ship on time, what kind of quality, what they wanted, and so on and so on. So we felt the purchasing practice was really unnecessarily stressful and unnecessarily tough to the suppliers. By the end of the year, since the performance of the buying office was very good, our boss, the boss of the buying office, had a chance to visit the headquarters to have a chat with the owner of the business. And then before he left, we had a talk and we both agreed we needed to report to the boss what's happening in the buying office. The life, the working life here is really unnecessarily stressful and unnecessarily exhausted. We want a change to the buying process. We want the purchasing practice have less, the last minute changes, have less unreasonable air shipment and the cost on the supplier side. We want to improve the purchasing practice, and we believe that improve can only happen if you change the buying policies. So the boss of the office left and went for the talk with the big boss of the group. And when he came back, he told me how it went. So the context here is that group is really big. They have lots of, the business is diverse. And garment is, of course, important section, but not the only business the group has. So when he came back, the boss said, I have a big picture. I'm looking at my big picture every day. And my big picture include IT, very important, including shipment, which is also very important, including the performance of each shop, very important, but not including the buying office. Buying office is a loop of the whole business. Of course, it's important, but it's not on the big picture. If the shipments were affected, that's really not good to the whole business. So when my boss told me this, yeah, I was waking up.
I want to clarify. So you mean that the response to what your boss had shared in Europe was that basically how stressed you guys were or how difficult your lives were, and also by extension, therefore, the suppliers that you were working with that were making the products was not like a relevant performance indicator or like relevant to the picture of success? Is that what you mean or something else?
I think after so many years, I still remember the exact sentences. So my understanding at that time and today is still like the performance of our buying office was very good because almost all the shipments arrived on time. And the qualities are okay. So shipment, on-time delivery is a very important KPI for the buying office. The quality of purchasing practice is not. So when buying office reflect to say the purchasing practice brought too much unnecessary stress to the suppliers and to the buying team, for the big boss. This is a, I don't know how he saw it. His reply is, I think your performance is good because shipment's on time and quality is okay.
I see.
So yes, maybe you can use the word irrelevant. So the actual purchasing practice on site is an irrelevant factor in his picture. In his picture, IT is very important because the shop is using IT. The base of the whole business is IT system. And for the whole business, for the retail business, shipment on time and quality okay is the foundation. But the purchasing practice is not. So that is the moment I realized something we were breathing every day haven't been seen in his picture, is invisible in his picture. And he has his point to have a picture like that. I could switch to his position to say, it's true, everything before the shipment is irrelevant to his views. That's our job. That's why he hired, he set up all this, he paid for all this buying office in China. We were there to fix the problem, to make sure goods arrive on time with good quality and with okay prices. As for how much stress during the process, how much pain brought, how much unnecessary argument, negotiation, all those stress brought to both buying team and suppliers, that is irrelevant.
So how did you feel right after this incident happened? You said it was a waking up moment. Did you understand that at the time, or is that something you realized later?
Even today, I cannot use a single word or a single emotional word to describe my feeling. I can just say it's a waking up moment. I felt at that moment, I felt, okay, I woke up. I woke up from one story to believe this is not right. What's happening is not right. Something is wrong. That's what I believed. Before my boss left to Europe, I believed something definitely is wrong in the whole process, in the whole system. So we needed to report that. We needed to report it, we needed to correct it. But after this conversation between me and my boss, I realized there is another story, or my story is just a part of this bigger story. The bigger story is, actually, you are right on that, but you also needed to know what you felt not right has nothing to do with the rest of the story. It's irrelevant. We wanted to have a change. We wanted to correct it. But in that system, in that setting, what we want just cannot be reached. Cannot be delivered. So that's really a weekend moment with a mixed feeling. I can't really analyze it even today. Maybe a little bit disappointed, maybe a little bit shocked, but it's really like you wake up from a dream.
Is it kind of like before this incident? I want to try to sort of be really precise about this idea of stories, and that you switched stories, or you got more stories, or you realized you were one small piece of a much bigger story. I want to sort of see if we can define that a little bit. Like, is it that before this incident, you felt like the team in Europe, they maybe didn't know or understand what was happening in China, and that once they knew or once they understood, that then their behavior would change? And so the realization, or to put it in your language of like stories, that you realized that you thought maybe they didn't have a piece of the story. And actually what you realized was that they, maybe they had it or they didn't have it, but actually that it didn't matter because they didn't care about that piece of the story. Is that fair or not fair?
Yes and no. Yes, because I totally agree with what you said just now, that before the incident happened, I thought they didn't know, the buying team and the top management in Europe, they didn't know the purchasing practice or the process could bring so much stress to this end. I thought they didn't know. And I thought once they know, they would like to change it. I thought they want to change it. They want to improve the situation. That's what I believed before the incident. After the incident, I realized maybe they know, maybe they don't, but once they know, they will not change it.
They cannot change it, or they don't want to change it because they're different.
For the top management, maybe they know, maybe they don't. Either way, they don't care. It's irrelevant. What matters most is still on-time delivery and good quality and okay prices. Those three things are the most relevant factors to their business decisions. So they know or they don't will not change their decisions. And for the buying team, in Europe, they cannot change it. They were part of the process as well. They don't have that decision power to decide, okay, I will not make last minute changes. Or they will say, okay, only 2 weeks before delivery, I will not do anything, just let it be. No, they will not. They will still repeatedly do what they have been doing all the time.
So I want to go back to sustainability. Before we started by, you shared a little bit about what assumptions you had about what was good and what was bad, what was sustainable, what was unsustainable. How did this incident sort of change that? Were there assumptions or beliefs that you let go of as a result of this incident? Were there new ideas or beliefs that you embraced instead?
It's quite interesting. So before the incident, as I mentioned earlier, my idea of sustainable fashion is very simple. Only two things: mutual, commercial, beneficial, and good for the environment, good for people. Very simple. After the incident, my idea of sustainable fashion, I lost my thoughts on sustainable fashion for a very long time. I don't have a clear answer. Until very late, probably, I have feelings, but I cannot use words to clearly describe what I was thinking. Until the moment we started to make a manufactured podcast. Actually, I think at the end of season one or at the end of season two, somehow I have more clear clues. And today I could share with that. So today, about sustainable fashion, my idea is not about anything specific. I would describe it like this. There are lots of values relevant to sustainable fashion, but those values could be conflicted if the values were placed in the system that the enforcement is top-down and the power dynamic is very unbalanced and the risks and the benefits are mismatched. So if I needed to give an example, I'm saying you could have your raw materials very sustainable, but can you call it a sustainable fashion if there is a business using sustainable materials but their practice is polluting the environment? Or their relationship between the workers or their relationship between the suppliers actually not ethical. First, you could be very ethical, but from a commercial viewpoint, how can you survive? Second, you can be very ethical, your practice, but are you sure your production or your practice can bring down carbon footprint? That's another thing. So you see, all those values are highly relevant to sustainable fashion. When we talk about sustainable fashion, we're more or less talking about all these things come and go. But if the system is wrong, if those values were placed in a system that enforcement is top-down, power dynamics is very unbalanced, like brands and suppliers, and the risks and the benefits are mismatched. Like you carry lots of risks, but your reward is almost nothing. And how can you not doubt those values? Or how can you deliver those values? Where are we going? What do we want to achieve? It's not a specific value or specific word anymore. It's a series of questions. And only when those questions are answered, I could say, okay, yes, that is sustainable fashion. And if I have to give a description to describe my sustainable fashion, I would say we can only have sustainable fashion in a system totally different from the current one. Before that system was built, sustainable fashion can only exist on a specific level. You cannot get a fashion sustainable on all the levels in the current system. That's my understanding today. Or maybe you can, but I really have doubts. I have doubts because on top of everything, a very successful business can be unethical in its practice, not good to the environment, unsafe practice in its workplace, and so on and so on and so on, but last a very long time in business world, as long as the cash keeps coming in. So how can you call that as normal if a business is very successful? Like, for example, Shein. We have so many bad comments and reports on internet about Shein. It's still alive. So tell me how, when the system allows such things happen, and in this system, within this system, we talk about sustainable fashion. How is that possible? What are we exactly talking about?
Divya, you've been quite quiet. I want to give you a chance to respond. What sort of feelings or emotions or images came to mind as you listened to Jesse's experience?
So lots of them. Let me try and see if I can find a way to articulate it. The word which I scribbled as I was listening to you was invalidated, invisibilized. It's almost literally the image was that the light going out. That's the image that, you know, went through my mind, because I think when we're talking about a workplace And we are doing our work with so much of passion and commitment. And we believe that what we are doing matters. And that, you know, how our quality of life, jobs and livelihoods is, would make a difference. I think that response that you are not a part of the big picture, one, I think, you know, I would say denial of, you know, the effort and invalidation of what you're doing actually being significant. But I think that is underpinned by perhaps the assumption that the how will take care of itself, right? We just focus on the what, which is the KPIs. This is what we measure and this is what we need done. We've set up an office. Somehow that office will deliver and function and keep things going. And unless there is a moment of rupture, we do not necessarily think about the how. Now, if someone was stressed enough to fall excessively sick, maybe, you know, harming themselves in some ways, those would have really raised the profile of those issues. And that is what triggered a lot of changes in workplaces. You know, sticking to the industry that we are talking to, or talking about, when there was the whole case about, you know, the worker in South India and, you know, the exploitation and the loss of life, that's when we woke up, right? When Rana Plaza happened, I mean, there was enough and more evidence about the limitations, but that became a wake-up call just because of the enormity of the impact. And I think in some ways, what you've just highlighted actually is sad. It makes me really, really sad if you ask about my emotions, because there is some quantitative KPI indicator which is determining the performance of the supply chain, and people's lived experiences just don't matter. It doesn't matter. You may think you are the boss within that buying house, you know, said you were the top two guys, right, working with the supplier, but it didn't really matter. You guys didn't matter. And there is a lot of resonance, I think, in some ways with my own experience as well in what you have just said. And then the questions that you've spoken about in terms of what is sustainability and the bigger picture. But one question which I do have for you is, first of all, would you agree with, you know, feeling this invalidated, or, you know, that black box of what goes on within a buying house, which is an intermediary and not really visible? What would change within the way the supply chains are managed within our industry if that was to really be given some attention? That's something that I'm just curious to know, which I think connects to the broader issues you raised about, you know, the values in sustainable fashion and what is valuable. Clearly, you guys were not valuable or not made to feel valuable, because your perspective was, you know, yeah, right, but you're not on the big picture. So that is one specific question I have for you.
If the response was different, if my experiences has been recognized as matters, not just by the boss, but also by the whole industry, it's good if it can be recognized by the whole industry. That means everyone, at least all the people who have decision powers, realize that the business model has a huge problem. Then our industry will be different. So my question would be, the economic life of a society is running in this way, profit-oriented. So inside this society economic life, if only garment industry changed, is that possible? Where is that possible? My answer is no, it's not possible. Something only business who follow this ethical practice will die, will be pushed out from the market. So the industry will went back to the same as before. And on the smaller level, on the macro level, if the big boss of the business responded to us in a different way, I would be happy, but also concerned. I would be happy like, oh, finally, they are aware something is wrong. They recognize that something is wrong. They will make a change. That's great. On the other hand, I will start to worry, how can you make sure your business can survive? As long as you start to realize your purchasing practice brought unnecessary stress and burnt out almost everyone from the supplier side and from the purchasing side, then you will make your purchasing cycle much longer. So your competition in the market as a brand will be impacted in a way you might not want to. So in that case, a higher question would be how you make sure your business can run as good as before. And so I'm quite pessimistic. I would like to imagine they took it seriously, but for the outcome, I don't think things can be changed. Maybe that's why so many years after, same story still happen and happen again in the purchasing offices.
What you are saying is that you expected change, but that change because it's subservient to the rules of the game within which the industry is situated, would generate conflicting. So you wanted to be heard, but you actually didn't want to be heard because you knew you couldn't be heard. And I think that is a interesting conundrum in some ways. But I think the point to take away, at least for me, before I hand it back to Kim, is that we need to kind of think about the wider rules which are determining the way the industry is really operating and what is being considered valuable. I think the whole phrase there would be fast fashion, right? Purchasing practices, timelines, turnaround, fast fashion. If fashion was done differently, if there were not as many seasons, then all of what you're saying would go away as pieces of the problem or the puzzle. And I think that's a much bigger conversation, which we can't delve into right now. But I think that was really interesting. But the point is to think about the rules of the game. I think that's where your invalidation has led me to, at least. But thank you so much.
I guess, Divya, I want to like ask a follow-up question or share what was going through my mind when you asked, you know, what if they had heard Jesse? What if Jesse had walked away from that encounter feeling visible, feeling seen? And the question that was running through my head was, are they capable of giving that recognition? Because, and I don't mean that from like the perspective of like, oh, they're bad people. They don't have the human capacity to give somebody else recognition. That's not what I mean at all. Where that question is coming from for me is a place of like having left my job as a factory manager in 2020 and been sort of more explicitly involved in the sustainability space since that time. I sort of feel like people who are in a position of power, I sometimes feel like they have certain blind spots, and it's hard to get them to see those blind spots. And what I hear often is, well, especially from people working in sustainability, which is a little bit different than the context, Jesse, that you're describing, which is really like a commercial relationship, but people who are working in sustainability in a global brand or retailer, or, you know, in an NGO that's maybe based in the global north or whatever, that they'll say to me like, well, we really want to engage with suppliers. We really want to understand better what their experience is, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll say all of the right things. And yet in their own behavior, they will behave in ways that kind of, as Jesse described, completely invalidate or dismiss that perspective. And so there's almost like they have this stated intention that they want to behave in a certain way, and yet their behavior every day sort of signifies something different. And I personally struggle to sometimes to point that out or to talk about it in a way that makes people see their own blind spot. Because what you guys are both talking about is sort of a shift when we think about sustainability, a shift to the broader structure, right? But if you're in a position of power, can you see the structure? And how do we help people to see the structure? And I've been, I don't know if this is going to make any sense at all, but I've been reading Kendi, How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is a completely different context. But I want to read, like, one of the thoughts that I had as I was reading that, he says, the opposite of racist isn't not racist, it's anti-racist. One either believes racial inequities are rooted in groups of people or in power and policies. Then I was thinking about this statement. Let me change the words up to words that are relevant to our context. The opposite of unsustainable isn't sustainable, it's anti-unsustainability. One believes unsustainable outcomes are rooted in groups of people, suppliers, the other in power or policies. And what Kendi says is basically that somebody who's not racist doesn't exist, because the whole, as you guys are saying, the whole system around them has to change. And as long as that system doesn't change, you can't be not racist, right? And that's kind of what, like, when, as Jesse, when you were talking, that's kind of what it reminded me of. It's like, if we don't change this whole system, you can't be sustainable. So maybe the opposite of unsustainable isn't sustainable. It's, and I know this is like a really clunky word, but anti-unsustainable, right?
I think the note which I made was the intention to want to engage, does it equal to the ability to be able to engage? And I think this is the bit which actually I will pick up, because this is what I want to unpack in our bit. But I think the intention may be triggered by certain moments, certain provocations, certain motivations. But if you're operating within the particular rules of the games, where does this intention really lead to? So when you're talking about, are they even capable of seeing? And that is more systematic, right? To be seen. I think that is where it comes down to Jesse's point around values and what is valuable. I think that is where in some ways it comes down to what are we considering as valuable, because that is what enables what is being seen. At least that's how I see it. And I think that's why maybe the pragmatic approach would be not to say that, you know, good is the opposite of bad, but maybe less bad. Maybe that's what, in some ways, what you're saying, that, you know, it's not possible to, but it's basically being anti-unsustainable, because maybe sustainability is something which we really don't know what it is, but we know what are the problems and what are the challenges within the unsustainable paradigm. So can we at least be anti that and try and address some of those bits? And maybe that will help us in some way create some sort of a constructive space forward. To kind of bring it full circle from Jesse's experience and the theme emerging there, is that it would not be possible to even have those spaces without a commitment to acknowledge that there are pieces of the puzzle which are missing, that not just we are committed to seeing those bits, seeing those experiences, recognizing them, and then trying to address them. And I think that's where this notion of power becomes a little more diffused, potentially, to have that space. I know this is a bit abstract, but but we've delved into really, really big questions.
How could the conversation with the three of us end up anywhere other than that, though? Jesse, I want to give you the final word, final thoughts.
Yeah, I do have something to say. And first, I like what you quoted from the book you were reading about racism. And I like your tweak it to sustainability. I just want to make it clear for everyone that when I say today, I don't have a specific answer to sustainable fashion. I don't have a clear definition. What I have is only a series of questions. When I say that, I don't question the efforts and practice people are doing on each specific level. I don't question that. My question is very simple. It's actually, if we don't change the system, if the system is still so much profit-oriented, how can we talk about sustainable fashion as if it's a goal we can achieve, as if it's a result can be accumulated by the sustainable practice on so many levels? If you don't jump out of the box, if you don't see the whole thing, if you don't see the system by taking a position out of the system, how can you, or let me put it this way, once you jump out of the box, once you try to see the system by taking a position out of the system, you will see so many sustainable practices and approaches are good, are helpful, delivered what they wanted to deliver. But it looks more like repairing the system instead of changing the system. And if the system is not changed on the sum, I don't think we could say we will have a sustainable fashion supply chain, or we will have a sustainable fashion. Because some settings are not right. That would be my final thoughts.
Thanks for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim von der Weert, and if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn or drop me an email on kim@manufacturedpodcast.com. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on. Take a look at the episode description for all the details and stay tuned for more.